Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Before I really get going here, I just want to inform you that I was a guest on Deanna Spingola's radio program on RBN last Thursday, March 10th. She has a two-hour show in the middle of the day, and Deanna is a very principled lady. She's a Christian. That she's very open to the truth on all levels, that she's not closed-minded in any way. And we talked about the lies about Adolf Hitler's genealogy and other lies about him, and she's really in pretty much in full agreement with what I have to say about it. And she's quite a researcher, historian on her own. She's very knowledgeable in a lot of areas. So we had a good program, and I encourage you to listen to that if you are able to. Now, speaking of internet radio programs, I just want to take the opportunity to say that I'm glad that I'm on the VOR network. I got on the VOR network because I picked it out. I wanted to have a, I just thought I'd tell this little story real quick. I wanted to have a program on Holocaust, on Holocaust revisionism, of which I knew there was nothing of that sort. And I thought the world needs to have a program on that where it's talked about in just normal terms, you know, and not in hushed tones, and here, you know, little spurts here and there. And I thought, what network would allow such a thing? And I, of course, knew that several wouldn't, and I asked around at those and found that out, too, to make sure. And then I was looking at something, somehow I got onto VOR, which I really was not that all that familiar with, but I had been listening to it some. And I thought, you know, I really like the way this network runs. And yes, they gave me the opportunity, and I've been here ever since. Now, I want to, and I'm quite happy with where I am and with the overall philosophy about political and racial issues that VOR has or stands for or holds in general. And I say that because there's been a lot of conversation, going around just lately about white nationalism and what it means and what it doesn't mean and who's a white nationalist and what's wrong with it, about Muslims and Jews, and it's all very confusing. And I think I would like to talk about it myself, but I don't want to get into disagreements with other people at this point. So, but that's all I'm going to say about that. But I missed my anniversary, ladies and gentlemen. My debut show here on VOR was on March 1st, 2010, and I had thought that I would make a note of that when that anniversary came up, but it totally passed me by. I've been really pretty overwhelmed with work, and in fact, I was telling Mike Connor that I think I need to take a break of at least a week or maybe 2 weeks in order to catch up with all my personal affairs, which I've been ignoring, and I have a lot of work deadlines too, but we'll see how that goes. Tonight, I will quickly revisit two topics from last week and cover a few more Hitler myths. And then I'll move on to our friend, not Gordon Duff, once again. Yes, Gordon Duff is saying things that are right in line with lies about Adolf Hitler, so I can't ignore that. I want to be sure and tell you that, as I said I was going to do, I wrote up the Hitler was a Jew disinformation that I did a program on, and now I'm into other myths about Hitler. But this one is really important, the grandfather of Hitler. So I have done that. I've posted it on my website, carolynyeager.com, and the title of it is The Fake Legends of Adolf Hitler's Jewish Grandfather. It's there as a permanent reference, which you can send anybody there who is trying to tell you about Hitler being a Rothschild or Hitler having Jewish antecedents. You can send them to that, and they can read the truth about it. I might add a little more to it. I might edit it a little if some new information comes up, but I think it's pretty conclusive and complete at this point. Has some pictures, too. So now, to go on with what I was talking about last week, and two items have brought up a lot of attention, but especially the one about the beatings that Adolf Hitler did or did not receive from his father. There are comments on the program page from last week that you might want to go to that and read them. There's some interesting information there and back and forth. And from looking into it more since last week and those comments and making comments of my own, I will say that naturally I think that Adolf Hitler probably had some, no doubt he had some beatings from his father. It would have been more the norm than the exception at that time for a son. But especially for Adolf, because he stood up to his father in this argument about what his future was going to be. And his father felt that he had to almost force his son into going the right way because he was being obstinate and not listening to reason. And so he may have gotten some beatings for that very reason. But my belief is that the beatings, and you can read some of the things I wrote on that program page from last week, but my feeling and the evidence itself shows that the beatings he got were some, but not that often, or, you know, not a regular occurrence. So I still think it's okay for me to say on that page that his father did not beat him, because when they're talking about beatings in these lies about Hitler, they start saying his father beat him every day, or he regularly beat him, or he beat him until he was practically dead, and, you know, he was an abused child, and none of that can be true. I'm not going to go into all the reasons. That's fairly obvious, but I also have written them in some of those comments, so we'll leave it at that for now. So I don't think I need to change that or say, oh, yes, he was beaten by his father, because, you know, a few beatings does not mean much from that time period, as I already said. All right, now the money, a bigger question comes up about whether Hitler had sufficient money, as I had said from Werner Maser, saying who had gone into his inheritance and said that he had plenty enough from his inheritance to support himself during all those years. Whereas Hitler gives something of a different story in Mein Kampf. And I'm going to read right now a little section from the end of the chapter, the first chapter in Mein Kampf. He talked about the happy days of his youth, but after his mother died, that put an end to all the hopes that he had, and he was a terrible blow. He says, I respected my father, but I loved my mother. Previous to this, he said that he was very fond of his father. And elsewhere, he said he loved his father. So there we go. But he loved his mother in a stronger way. Now he's saying, poverty and stern reality forced me to decide promptly. The meager resources of the family had been almost entirely used up through my mother's severe illness. The allowance which came to me as an orphan was not enough for the bare necessities of life. Somehow or other, I would have to earn my own bread. Well, this, as we found out last week, this orphan's allowance was 25 kronen a month, which would not have been enough for him to live on, really. But that was supposedly joined by the inheritance from his mother. But he is saying that it was used up by his mother's illness. Now, this is the big question. Was it or was it not? Maser, who has looked at all the records, never mentions that the inheritance that Hitler got could have been used up by his mother's illness and funeral. So I don't know, because I don't read anything more about it, but I do have some things to say about the experience that Hitler had in Vienna in the beginning, and this sheds a little light on it, or might shed some light on it. First, I had said last week that his mother sold that big house, or I made it sounded that way, that the house that she sold was that big house. But that's not the case. The big house that they lived in was before Adolf's father, Alois, died. He sold that house. And they moved to Leonding and bought a house in Leonding. And that was a smaller house. It was a nice house. Looked like, there's pictures in the book. Looked like a nice house, but not as big as the other one. Of course, I think at that time the family was then only the parents and Adolf and Paula, his sister. So then when the father died, his mother sold that house in Leonding. That's where she got the 10,000 kronen, and they moved to Linz. And they rented a house in Linz. She didn't buy a house, so she had that money, and that was the money that was probably a large part of their family funds. Now, Hitler went to Vienna, and then his mother, he tried to get into the Academy of Art and failed. But then he found his mother was diagnosed with cancer, and it had gotten pretty bad. And so he returned home, and he took care of his mother for 2 months before she died. And this is where, you know, were the funds used up or not. But after, in February 2008, she died in December 2007, the very end of the month, right before Christmas. And in February the next year, he returned to Vienna now on his own. He had taken care of the financial situations, and he had what he had. We're not sure what he had, but he shared a room with Kubizek. And according to Kubizek, neither one of them had very much money, and their room wasn't very great, but they had a nice landlady. And Hitler began taking drawing and painting lessons. Now, he had to have some money for that. But according to Kubizek, he didn't have enough to really eat right. But Mauser says that Kubizek doesn't always tell the truth either. Here you go. He's kind of presenting things according to... He took some of it from Mein Kampf. You know, we don't know exactly who to believe from this, but we have to look, do the best we can. Now, when Kubizek went into the army in September of that year, Hitler again tried to get into the academy, and he failed. So now, in November, he left that room that he shared with Kubizek, and he went to stay in a place on Felberstrasse, and he remained there until August 1909 for 9 months. Now, we don't know what he did there, but he did not report for military service. You see, Kubizek had gone ahead and let himself, he reported like he was supposed to, and he was called up for duty and had to do his military service. Well, Hitler did not want to do it. He, as I've said before, he did not like the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. He didn't like their military, and he didn't want to be in their army. Mauser says he was moving around during that year to avoid the military authorities who were looking for him to enlist. But in any case, he was at that one place until 1909. He was probably doing some painting and trying to sell his paintings. In August 20th, December 16th, he took a room for, now this see, is only 1 month, at another place. And then on September 16th to November, about 2 months, he was a subtenant in another place. And then November to the end of 1909, the last 2 months of the year, or the month and a half or whatever, his address was Meidling Doss House. A Doss House is a kind of a place where you only sleep. It's like for homeless people, where you just, there's a place, you know, you go, maybe you pay a tiny amount, and you go in at night, and you, you know, lay down somewhere where there's a bed, there's a bunch of beds, and then in the morning you have to leave. You can't stay there during the day. And that's where he met Reinhold Hanisch, and they agreed that Hanisch would sell his paintings. Now, Hanisch was a trained draftsman, Mauser says, so why he was staying in that place, I don't know. But Mauser says that maybe when he was in that Doss House, and he couldn't stay there during the day, he maybe went out and worked as a laborer for during the days, because he had to go somewhere. And there had been a lot of laborers around there. So all of this is like, in that year, he moved around a bit. He wasn't stable. That would have been the hard year for him, the really tough one. But how tough it was, we don't really know, except that he says he ran into a lot of the lower class and lived among them, and probably he did. But in December of that year, he moved into this men's hostel. And he stayed there until 1913, so 3 years, or 3.5 years. And that's where he, of course, he had his own room or rooms, and he painted during the day and there, and Hanisch sold his paintings. And it said, according to the records now, with Maser, his paintings began to bring in so much money that between May 1911 and April 1913, now there again, that's 2 years, he voluntarily gave his orphan's allowance to his sister Paula. Now, the orphan's allowance, remember, was 25 kronen a month. So he felt he didn't need that, and he wanted to help his sister. He was really a good fellow. And it was because he was now seriously painting, and he had gotten pretty much established in a better way than he was that previous year. But I think according to what he says in Mein Kampf, he was painting during that year too, but he didn't have a place where he was comfortable. Then it was in May 1913 that he moved to Munich, and there he lodged with Joseph Popp's family, as I told you. But the Austrian police did catch up with him then, and he had to go and enlist, which he did, in Salzburg. And he took a physical, but you know, he was rejected. So it was like good fortune. His providence was smiling on him, because he didn't want to go into that Austrian army anyway. So they rejected him. But only less than a year later, he's back. He's in Munich, and war breaks out, and he enlisted in the Bavarian Infantry Regiment, and they accepted him. Of course, it was now wartime, where previously it was not wartime. In 1914, October, he went to the front. So that's the best I can do on that story about whether he was poor or comfortable or what, how much money he had. Now, let's turn to the sexual angle, because there are a lot of things said about Adolf Hitler which are not true, naturally related to sex. So one is Hitler contracted syphilis in Vienna, which affected him for the rest of his life. No, not true. He had a thorough physical with lots of tests done in 1940, which is on record, and that I think in 1940 was when he started feeling he had some health problems, and he may have asked for this extensive physical. And during this checkup, they tested for syphilis and probably any kind of that type of disease, and they were all those tests were negative. He never had a venereal disease. Now, number two on my little list here is this, the idea Hitler was a homosexual. A lot of people like to say that, just another one of these slanders. No, absolutely not. And in fact, Maser has a good story, because, you know, Hitler had lots of women in his life, and nobody has ever seriously said they had an affair with Adolf Hitler, no man. But Maser said that in 1952, he spoke personally with a doctor who was a homosexual, who had x-rayed Hitler before the war, and this doctor told him, "I was fascinated by Hitler's eyes, speech, and gait, but I could tell at once he wasn't one of us." And you know that homosexuals, both male and female, can tell right away whether someone is one of them or not. Now, also, I'll just mention that Hitler's landlord in Munich, Herr Popp, or his name is Joseph Popp, said that Hitler never took a girl up to his rooms, and during the daylight hours he painted, and the evenings were spent discussing politics and war with the Popp family. Well, you know, Hitler was a... He liked to talk and discuss, and he was a nice, he lived a nice, pretty clean life. He was serious about his future still. He was still trying to, you know, do well and make it. And so he was managing to do that through his painting at that time. And he was very close to the Popp family. He was like one of the family. They liked him, and obviously he liked them and was comfortable with them. And he didn't have that many people in his life at that time, and he went out and sold his own paintings, but mostly to dealers, so he didn't have to go out and panhandle them. He took them to dealers, and the dealers sold them. Okay, neither Herr Popp or his wife ever saw Hitler in the company of a woman or heard him mention a girlfriend during the time that he was, that year that he was in, stayed with them in Munich, according to them. But when he came back from the war, and more is known about his life, there were always women in his life. There was usually some woman in his life. He did see women, take women out, spend time in women's company. And women, several women committed suicide or tried to commit suicide over him. But I'm not going to go into that right now. Now, the fourth thing, Hitler's the story that Hitler had only one testicle. No, not true again. Now, this is interesting. But first I'll say that he was examined many times by doctors. He had all kinds of physical examinations. They're all on record, or I think they're all, or most of them. There are voluminous medical records that are available for Adolf Hitler. These were never destroyed. In all of them, his genitals were completely normal. This was, you know, when they were ever examined, and they were examined. He didn't mind having himself looked over everywhere. So this story seems to come from the Soviets. They recovered a body from the bunker. They say was Hitler. Hitler's body. They recovered it in early May 45. And this body, once it was shown to the rest of the world or whatever, was shown that it had only one testicle. And in fact, the entire testicle, even inside, was something was missing there. So this person was a one-testicled person. It wasn't like the testicle was lost or something. It never existed. But other problems with this body, that it had the wrong teeth because there were dental x-rays of Adolf Hitler, and it was close, but not exactly right. And also, it was shorter, 3 inches shorter than Hitler was known to be. So it appears that the Soviets were trying to pass this body off as Hitler, that they're hoping that they had found Hitler, but they didn't. Anyway, Hitler shot himself, according to the people in his entourage, the people close to him at the time, either in the mouth or in the temple. And according to these few people, one of which was his chauffeur, personal chauffeur, Kempke, and the other his personal pilot, Bauer, these were the two, and a few others, but these were the two maybe specially who he entrusted to carry out his wishes with his body after he and Eva had committed suicide. And, you know, of course, even the shooting part, they want to say that Hitler did not shoot himself because that's considered more manly to shoot yourself with a gun. They want to say that he bit into a capsule, that he just took a cyanide capsule. But the fact is he did shoot himself. But she took the cyanide capsule, and then he shot himself in the head. And so his head was... according to these witnesses, his head was pretty much shattered by this gunshot. And they wrapped his body in something. Then they took it to a garden area there in the bunker, and they burned it. And they had 40 gallons of petrol was all that this Kempke could come up with. And the other fellow, Bauer, said if he had known that that was all he was going to be able to scrounge up at that time, he would have done it. They would have burned him in a different manner. But they had this, and they had to split it between the two, so they each had 20 gallons of petrol. But they said that Hitler's body burned for 2.5 hours, for certain, after which there was very little left. His body and his head. His head was really gone. I mean, there was just a little something, you know, some bony stuff left, but even some of that was gone. You could never have recognized either one of them. And then they wrapped what was left, those remains, in a canvas and buried it in a shell hole just outside the exit from the bunker. And I imagine that they don't really talk much about Eva. Everything is only about Hitler, but I'm sure that they did the same with her. Therefore, this dead man that the Russians had was probably something that they found, and they were hoping that it was Hitler, and then they wanted to pass it off as Hitler for whatever reasons they have, but they really do like to lie. I mean, they just lie. I don't know why they can't be more honest about things. Another story is that they just didn't find the body, or the body had been removed by trusty followers before the arrival of the Russians, as Gunche says. Now, there's a fellow named Gunche. I don't know the relationship. He's one of those longtime assistants of Hitler that he really trusted the most. It is said by some of his friends that he once told them that he and a couple others or whatever had removed Hitler's body and taken it somewhere else after they didn't leave it there. Now, that can't be ascertained, so that's just another story. But the fact that the Russians really, the Soviets really looked for Hitler's body and apparently did not find it. But I hope that doesn't lead you to believe that Hitler survived the bunker. Because he was in no shape after being burned for 2.5 hours. And I don't mean to be making light of that, but to leave the bunker. And he didn't want to either. So that's, I'm glad I got through that, ladies and gentlemen. And we will take a break now. And when I come back, I will go on to our friend Gordon Duff.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Democracy and equal rights, but perhaps not for all Americans, and I'm talking specifically about the case of Bradley Manning. Like I said earlier, the hacking collective group Anonymous has taken up the case of Bradley Manning. They have threatened potential retribution for U.S. officials and various corporations if the case of Bradley Manning, if his conditions were not improved. They've given the deadline of Monday, and, well, the deadline has come and gone. I'm joined now by the informal spokesman for the group, Barrett Brown in Dallas, Texas. Barrett, thank you so much for being here. So has the Pentagon listened to you?
I'm afraid the Pentagon has decided to probe us, but they haven't quite managed to reach out to us and talk to us.
It's a shock.
It is a shock, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So today, of course, is the deadline. They have not improved Manning's condition. As such, we're going forward with our original plan, which was to eventually cause some distress for those responsible, including a certain brig commander and a certain other former brig commander. Also a certain spokesman for a certain five-sided building. Addition to that, we are also going forward with Operation Metal Gear, which we just conceived today. Operation Metal Gear concerns a company called Booz Allen Hamilton. It's a federal contractor, does intelligence work for a number of companies, has offices in Baku and, of course, Virginia, very similar places in many ways. We happen to know they have a project going on. We know this from the emails that we acquired from H.B. Gary during our investigation. We know that the project is considered to be potentially dangerous by a source who is close to it.
What's the nature of this project?
The nature of this project is still unspecified. It's software-based, and we know that it is of interest to the same people that did this H.P. Gary conspiracy. For instance, Aaron Barr was brought in for a meeting at Booz Allen Hamilton's office in late January, right around the time he was going around pimping his anonymous coverage, his research that he thought he had. And as such, we know that, and since they discussed the project with Aaron Barr beforehand on the phone, as we know through the emails, and because of other things we found out, we know that it therefore is relevant to the kind of research that Aaron Barr was doing, which we all know involved a lot of dangerous stuff involving invasions of privacy of individuals, investigation of political opponents, using their families as sort of anchors, and even stuff like the Air Force, which they were, you know, asking for bids on a program whereby a single airman could control a 500-person army of fake people online. These are dangerous developments, and Anonymous is still looking into them.
So is this an official declaration of war against Booz Allen Hamilton and possibly other contractors?
Yeah, we just got around to declaring that war just now, but we've been at it all day.
All right. Well, let's talk about the situation with Bradley Manning. Obviously, we've seen P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesman, resign. Not a fan of Bradley Manning or WikiLeaks, for that matter. What does that say to you?
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Well, Gordon Duff has done it again. He's written another article which has inspired or enraged me to comment on it. This is one that was published on Veterans Today on March 10th, titled, Are You a War Criminal? And in, as he likes to do, condemning George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and all that crowd and what Americans are doing in for Israel and to the rest of the world, he always relates it back to the National Socialist period in Germany, the Nazis, and Adolf Hitler. And he's done it again. Now, you know, to introduce this again, Gordon Duff gave us the Bush-Nazi connection. That's when I got started noticing what he was doing, which I've talked about quite a bit on this program. And he gave us the Zionist-Nazi coin that I have featured on one of my programs that was in reality a cheap advertising medallion by a party newspaper. So he, you know, he is misrepresenting these things. Then he gave us his attempts to talk about the German concentration camps and the Holocaust survivors in various articles that he's written, in which all of his information was wrong. In fact, he claims to have been at, say, Buchenwald, when he has clearly not been there, or if he had was there, he must have been sleepwalking, because he didn't know anything about it, and everything he said was wrong. This I take as relating very definitely and very importantly to my interest in the way Jews lie and why they're lying and what it's like to be living under Jewish lies, which is Jewish rule. Jewish rule, Jewish lies about our history. Our history. I will repeat again. You might not like Adolf Hitler. You might not like the National Socialists, but is that a reason to lie about what took place, to misrepresent it in the most blatant and ignorant ways, and take away our history so that we can study our history and make our decisions about it based on some accuracy, not on a bunch of Jewish lies? So, I won't go into any more about him. Now, I'm going to go into this article. I'm going to quote something. You know, he's talking about the war criminals. He's talking about the current war criminals, all right? So he says, though Nazi traditions may have virtually disappeared from Germany, the history of the last 66 years has made one thing clear. Nazi traditions have found a home around the world, sometimes as conservative or Tory or neocon or Christian nationalism or Wahhabism, and even under the guise of Zionism. Oh my. The results are always the same, he writes. Concentration camps, mass graves, terror bombing of civilians, and a slick public relations campaign heavily financed by the moneyed elite. Well, I'm going to stop right there and make a comment, because terror bombing of civilians took place against the Germans by the Allies much more than it took place by any Nazis. And he says the Nazi traditions may have virtually disappeared from Germany. Of course, he is implying that they have not disappeared from the United States, and I guess he would even accept that they can be seen in Israel, too, because he is taking the position that Israel, along with the United States, is carrying out Nazi policies, but he is separating that all the time from Jews and Judaism around the world, which I don't believe you can do. But let's continue here that he says, a slick public relations campaign heavily financed by the moneyed elite. Here again, supposedly, Nazi Germany had slick public relations, which they were not anywhere close to what Britain had, and then the United States, once it really got going, nothing close to it. And it was not heavily financed by the moneyed elite, but that's part of his disinformation that he puts out, that Hitler and the Nazi Party totally was financed by the wealthy bankers and Jews, etc. Now he writes, in 1940, Adolf Hitler was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. And he's got a picture here of that issue of Time Magazine with Hitler's picture on it. You know, and he says no more about it. And even his commenters are saying, you know, Gordon, you're claiming that by saying this way and showing this magazine, that somehow Time Magazine, as part of the moneyed elite, was promoting Adolf Hitler by making him their Man of the Year in 1940, when we all know that the Time Magazine Man of the Year has been all kinds of people, including Joseph Stalin and Osama bin Laden, and people, because it's chosen by on the basis of whoever's the most newsworthy, not who they're promoting, and everyone knows that. So there's his first twisted truths. Now, he goes on to write about other things, and then he brings this up again. I quoting again, he writes, "What is a war criminal?" Duff answers his question, "What is a war criminal?" with this video of Donald Rumsfeld. A little bit of Eichmann and a little bit of Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes, we see the classic dodges, outright lying, followed by blaming others, with the Rumsfeld blade going into the back of George W. Bush over and over and over. You know, my comment here, this is so arbitrary. Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld is a little bit of Eichmann, a little bit of Sergeant Schultz. Okay, you know, bringing up these people that everyone can remember and relate to, and they have ideas about. Of course, Eichmann was really not guilty of the things that even he claimed he was guilty of, but he was in the custody of these Israelis for a long time, and he thought that if he went along with what they wanted him to say, that he was going to escape the noose. But, you know, he was naive. Even though he was half Jewish, he was still a little bit naive, and it didn't happen. And Sergeant Schultz, of course, is that TV character that epitomizes the bumbling, stupid German. And that's where we go with this type of imagery. We go from the conniving, brilliant murderer Eichmann and the bumbling Hun, a German who, you know, just is interested in swilling beer and eating sausage. Always negative stereotypes. But the important thing is that Duff goes on and says, who can be charged? And then he writes, on October 16th, 1946, Julia Streicher, publisher of Der Stürmer, a German newspaper, was hanged. By today's standards, his paper was pretty tame stuff. What he did was propagandize the German public, pre-staging persecution and murder of gypsies and other minorities, including Jews, euthanizing the useless, the developmentally disabled, the handicapped, and other groups, and, of course, supporting the government cover story on the Reichstag fire, a 9/11-type incident. Now, he has packed a lot into that little paragraph, bringing up Julia Streicher for whatever reason, who really was not an important part of the Nazi hierarchy, and he had his anti-Jewish newspaper, big deal, but I guess I shouldn't say big deal, because it didn't have the effect that so many people now want to give it. But saying that he pre-staged the persecution and murder of gypsies and other minorities, it's funny the way Duff is putting that. He's putting the gypsies first and then just including the Jews amongst other minorities, because he wants to focus on all the other people who were killed. And gypsies were not murdered. Very few gypsies died during that period of time, during World War II. This story about gypsies being exterminated and the number of them is totally exaggerated. But the thing is that right here, he is bringing up the Reichstag fire again, saying that the Reichstag fire was a false flag operation just like 9/11, which it was not. Gordon Duff says he's a historian. First, he's a journalist, and he's not a good journalist because he's not accurate or truthful, and he lies. And then he's not a historian at all because he doesn't even know history. He's never known history. I don't know what makes him think he can call himself a historian, but that's what liars do. They say anything. And now he's got a picture here. He said, the Reichstag fire, all historians, almost, except for the real aggressive Jewish ones, say that the Reichstag fire, there's no evidence that it was done by the National Socialists or the Hitler or by Goering, who is supposedly the one who's arranged that. And that everything points to the fact that it was done by this communist, and for the reasons that he had, and the German court that took care of that was fair and found him guilty, but let the others go that were his accomplices, because they didn't really have enough evidence against those guys, but they did have the evidence against this other fellow. And here Duff has put together a picture with George Bush's face and a picture next to him of the plane flying into the Twin Tower. And then below that, Adolf Hitler's face with a picture of the Reichstag burning back then. And if that's even that picture, but anyway, that's what it represents. And he puts the word separated at birth or coincidence. So what he's saying is these two are so much alike, they are Siamese twins. Were they separated at birth, or is it just a coincidence that George Bush was behind the 9/11, which probably he wasn't? You know, he was just a guy going along with it, but he wasn't behind it, probably. And Adolf Hitler, who supposedly set fire to his own parliament house in order to establish some stricter laws, this is his idea, but there's no evidence for this. But he's using this imagery to show that Bush is a Nazi. This is his same old idea. George Bush is a Nazi. This is really ludicrous, and we'll go on and find this out. Now he writes, Minister of Propaganda Joseph Goebbels had already committed suicide. Well, he's now at the end of the war. His efforts represented the official government policy toward using information as war. In his own bumbling way, Duff, he's saying that Joseph Goebbels used information as war. Well, you know, in wartime, you use information as war. That's what's called propaganda. But they all did. And as I already mentioned, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, was far more adept at using information as war. And so was the Soviets. So were the Soviets. They're very, very good at that. And they were all better than Joseph Goebbels at it, although he was talented and he did a good job, but he wasn't as unscrupulous, truth to tell, as they were. And then the Americans became that good at it also. And so they really are the ones who did a war of information and a war of propaganda. Well, he's tying that in with the global war on terror. You know, again, that all goes back to Hitler and the Nazis. But what I really want to say is that he's got a picture here of the SS belt buckle, Gott mit uns, which is God with us, which is on the belt buckle of the SS. Now, here's what our dear friend Gordon Duff says. With few exceptions, such as Blue Bloods, starring Tom Selleck, racist propaganda spews into Americans' homes like a deluge. Okay, oh, he's so against racism. Of course, that the Nazis were racist, and racist propaganda is out of control today in the United States, and that's why it's a Nazi country. Whether CSI or NCI, well, I know CSI is a television program, but maybe NCI is the same thing, a similar one. The story is generally the same: prejudice, racism, fear-mongering, and propaganda. Every phony sleuth and action hero has done their part to brainwash America and need to be called to account. Okay, well, he wants to get rid of all all people who are putting forth anything racist. That's what he's really about. And now about this belt buckle, he says, he's got the caption under it, from the Nazi Torah, Gott mit uns. Oh, he calls it the Nazi Torah now. Oh my God, the Nazi Torah. Then he's got this little heading, the unholy men of God, and he spelled God, G-D. That's the Judaic spelling. Why is Gordon Duff spelling it that way in his article? Does he always spell it that way? I haven't noticed. Maybe he doesn't use the word God that often, but he's spelling the Jewish spelling of God because he's a practicing religious Jew. Is that the idea? He writes, a common Nazi belt buckle said, and he's got it again, G-T-T, mit uns. He won't write out the word God, but he did when he says, when he's describing what's in the picture. Then he says the Nazi party was always Christian. Kirche, Kinder, Kuchen, church, children, kitchen. That supposedly is either bad or it's hypocritical of them, and that's just more part of their kitsch stuff. Then he says, as Christian and anti-Semitic as Nazi Germany was, he's tying together anti-Semitic with Christian, and he does this all the time, ladies and gentlemen, in his articles, whether you can recognize it or not. It was, he says, as nationalistic, racist, and extremist. Now, there he's tying together nationalism with racism and extremism. And then he goes on, American and Israel, he doesn't know how to write very well, so he should say America and Israel, have surpassed that aspect of Nazi doctrine with ease. So we are, ladies and gentlemen, a Nazi country, and we really need to self-destruct, I guess. America needs to be destroyed, according to Gordon Duff, because it's been taken over by Nazis and it personifies Nazism. Now, here's more of what he wrote. Then he says there is Israeli military historian Martin Ben Krevel. Now, he's quoting an Israeli military historian who is a real scumbag, but he's quoting him in order to show, again, what we are. He says, we have hundreds of nuclear warheads and missiles that can reach different targets in the heart of the European continent, including beyond the borders of Rome, the Italian capital. Our armed forces, however, are not the 30th strongest in the world, but rather the second or third. This is Krevel speaking about Israel. We have the capability to take the world down with us. So Krevel is an Israeli historian who is bragging about how tough and strong Israel is. And Gordon Duff has taken this quote, possibly out of context, but anyway, he's taken this quote and put it here. Then he says about it, Duff's comment about it, doesn't he sound like he is sitting in the Führer bunker in Berlin, April 1945, threatening the Allied armies closing in on him? No, he doesn't. Because in the Führer bunker, they didn't have the ability in 45 to do any such thing. But he says, this kind of childish insanity is common in Israel, common in America, and the kind of thing heard as part of religious worship, and of course he's meaning Christians, by millions of families. 40% of American Christians belong to violent Zionist sects. The leaders of these sects are considered war criminals for advocating mass killing, race war, and torture. In America, of those who supported illegal torture policies of the Bush administration, over 85% were from these extremist red state sects. So now he's getting in, you know, the red states. I live in a red state. The red states are bad. The right wing of any type is bad. The Christians are bad because there are these red state types too. So we need to realize what this man is doing and ask, why the heck is he doing it? Now, he fools some of his readers, and he doesn't fool others. I've got some comments here. He's got two followers that comment all the time on his site. And by the way, I am banned from, I've never been told that, but if I write a comment there, I have my little box under there, and I have the name that I gave that I originally wrote with. I wrote a few comments early on, and it's still there, but if I write in it and click submit, nothing happens. It's just, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. But he's got this guy, Texas Vet, and another guy, TJ Bronco. And they are two, I would say, rather uneducated regulars because they don't know anything about history either. And they think that everything Gordon writes is just terrific. And they write lots of comments. I'm finding that under Gordon Duff's articles, there are now a less variety of commenters and more comments from the same people. But there are a few that are trying to counter what he's doing, so I will get to those. But these two, you know, they go on. This first one, this is something that actually Gordon Duff wrote, and he's repeating it. Don't forget the 1 million-plus gypsies who were used as forced target practice. First, Hitler's goal was to eliminate any possible group that could organize against him, including Catholic priests and their flocks. Pope John Paul II was a young Catholic man and best childhood friend of one of my very good friends. You should have heard the stories. Okay, this is what Texas Vet was saying. And he'd got that 1 million-plus gypsies as target practice from what Duff wrote. But, you know, they just believe it. They just believe all that. They don't look into it. Then, though, there's a fellow named Ray Monk who is trying to bring some reason in. And he points out in his comment that Joseph Stalin was Time's Man of the Year, and so was Ayatollah Khomeini, the Time Man of the Year in 79. Stalin in 39 and Hitler in 40. So see, you know, he's saying that from the Time Archive, he wrote, he copied down some of what was in the article and certainly wasn't pro-Hitler in any way. So he does say that Gordon Duff is twisting things around and presenting it as something that it's not. And then Weymouth comes back, somebody tells him, oh no, believe in Gordon. And then he says, yes, but I think the point of posting that picture was to suggest that Time was endorsing Hitler. You are twisting that into the whole article. You're twisting that into the whole article's dog shit and I hate it. That's what he's saying Gordon Duff is doing. He quotes some things from what Duff said and he says, Time's negative article on Hitler is the complete opposite of what Gordon Duff was trying to convey, in my opinion. The mainstream media supports Israel like they used to support Hitler. No, he says that's not true. The media supports Israel for the reasons it does, but he says the media didn't support Hitler. It was supporting Uncle Joe Stalin. So he, you know, he goes on and on with some very good stuff. I don't think I have time to read it all. But he does this frequently. He is criticizing what Gordon is writing on, he's done this in other, on other articles too. Now, but these people don't listen. Now, there's another good commenter named Michael J. Volz, and he makes this intelligent observation. Gordon, some of these discussions wind up making me a little confused. I get the feeling sometimes a simple subject is being made complicated. Now, that's what I've, that's disinfo, friends, okay? Michael goes on, so complicated, in fact, only a liberal, progressive, American Jewish academic who is a regular consultant for the History Fabrication Channel and regular expert on C-SPAN, the truth, C-SPAN, he needs span the truth, is smart enough to fully explain it, and he has four or five question marks and four exclamation marks after that, which is he's being, he's being tongue-in-cheek. So he goes on and writes, seems like the whole story of Nazi Germany could be summarized without ever mentioning Hitler's name. He says, a small group of manipulative MFers struck Germany with an unfair bill for World War I. They, as a small minority, hijacked the levers of power in Germany. The same group declared war on Germany in 1933, which was, Germany was in ruins. Germany rebelled. And the same small group of manipulators, again, these MFers, won their war and punished the country again. And he puts in parentheses Dresden. Where does the name Hitler fit into all that? He is saying it wasn't Hitler who destroyed Germany and did all this stuff to Germans. It was these manipulative MFers. And he says it could have been anyone to lead the revolt. Mueller, the only thing particular about Hitler was he was so successful for so long in throwing off the yoke. Someone had to be demonized. By the way, he says, I think Hitler was a very accomplished artist, not the pathetic failure the tribe has branded him to be. He says, but, you know, you can never win. He says, they will always have the last word, and signs off. You know, I think Michael J. Volz may be listening to my radio program, because that may be where why he got the idea about Hitler being a very accomplished artist, when he wrote this, which was after that program. So, Michael, if you're out there, welcome, and I'm glad you're listening. I hope you'll continue listening, and I'll continue reading your letters on your comments on the Veterans Today. Okay, that is all I have for now. I think I've taken care of that well enough. I encourage you all to be very careful in your reading and listening, and really demand a higher level, a higher standard than what you are receiving in most places on the internet. And there are a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of sites now that are getting worse and worse instead of better and better. So that maybe will be a subject for a later time. But for now, thank you very much for listening. I believe I am done with the Hitler myths for the time being, certainly, and we'll be moving on to some other things. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.